I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, and this is On Point, a new term and a new associate justice on the Supreme Court this week.
If you have a neutral plan and someone comes in and upsets it to racially gerrymandered in favor of one racial group, well, necessarily you're going to be harming some other group on account of race.
But why are you saying counsel? It's a neutral plan, counsel? I don't understand. The Jingles preconditions are designed to establish that there may actually be race discrimination working in this particular situation.
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wasted no time participating in oral arguments. Jackson is the first Black woman to serve on the court, replacing Justice Stephen Breyer. What you heard was Jackson pushing back against Alabama Solicitor General Edmund LeCur in oral arguments in a voting rights case this week. Jackson points out that racial discrimination has already been baked in where congressional lines are being drawn through segregated housing.
These are really tough things to establish, and collectively, they show that it's not neutral, the situation that we are approaching in this situation. We're talking about a situation in which race has already infused the voting system.
We'll have more moments from inside the court throughout this hour. We have a preview of what Jackson will bring to the court and the landmark cases it will be hearing this term. But let's begin with the cases it heard this week. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Amy Howe. She is a longtime Supreme Court reporter for SCOTUS blog and her own blog, Howe on the Court. She has taught Supreme Court litigation at Stanford and Harvard and also argued two cases before the Supreme Court. Amy, it's so great to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to talk to you.
And Carolyn Shapiro is also with us from Phoenix, Arizona. She is founder and co-director of Chicago Kent School of Law's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. She also served as Illinois Solicitor General from 2014 to 2016 and has argued cases in the Supreme Court as well. Carolyn, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to start out by talking about this court's new supermajority. Amy, going in with this court, it's a little different than it is in a lot of at the start of a lot of terms where you may have some idea of what the court might do. But what is it like covering this 6-3 majority that's coming out right out of the gate this term?
I think you sort of hit it on the nail. It seems at least like the justices are likely to be much more predictable. And so sometimes even when one of the conservative justices doesn't necessarily ask any questions or many questions, as happened in the Alabama voting rights case, you may already have a signal of where you think the court is likely to go. In that case, for example, the five more conservative justices actually put a lower court order on hold earlier this year and agreed to take up the case, you know, which allowed Alabama to use this map that a lower court had found likely violates the Voting Rights Act in the 2022 election. So you have a pretty strong signal of where the justices are even before the first lawyer gets up to stand and says, you know, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
And Carolyn, to you, this 6-3 majority that we have this term compared to years past and, you know, people listening who have thought about the Supreme Court, what should they be looking out for, listening for from the court to get a better understanding about where this majority is?
Well, it's always a little bit risky to make too many predictions based on oral argument, but I think it's fair to say that going into the term, we have, along the lines of what Amy said, a pretty good sense of how the court is likely to rule in a significant number of the high-profile cases. We don't know for sure. And so the thing I think to look out for in oral argument is whether there are any justices who we think of as being pretty firmly in that six-justice majority who are asking questions to that indicate that they may be interested in doing something more unexpected.
Okay. And there were four cases argued this week, but two have gotten a lot of attention. The first being a case about the Clean Water Act that was argued on the first day. The issue involves defining what the word adjacent means in terms of regulations and rules protecting wetlands. But this case does have the potential to really roll back the authority of the EPA. Amy, explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so the technical question in this case is what test courts should use to determine whether a wetland is covered by the Clean Water Act so that the EPA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers can regulate it. And the argument that the property owners in this case was making, this is a couple who was trying to build a home on land, sort of a row of houses and a road over from a lake called Priest Lake in Idaho. They dumped a bunch of sand and gravel to start to prepare the land for construction. And then they got a notice from the EPA that said, this is a wetland and you need to put it back essentially the way it was. And their argument is that unless water flows from the wetland to this larger body of water, that the EPA can't regulate it. And the EPA says all you need really is a significant connection between the wetland and the larger body of water. And the government's argument is that wetlands have a real effect on the waters that they flow into, and that a more stringent definition of what's covered by the Clean Water Act could affect millions of acres of wetlands. There was concern that the test that the property owners, it was a little bit like Goldilocks, that the test that the property owners were proposing might be too restrictive and not bring enough wetlands into the coverage. But then once you get away from that, some of the conservative justices asked, like, what is the test and how are homeowners going to know whether or not their land is covered by the Clean Water Act? So it's a kind of a balancing act.
Yeah, and Carolyn, listening to that case going in, I understood that this could give the court a chance to really roll back the EPA's authority, but it's hard to judge by oral arguments. It seemed in this case that the court was perhaps looking for a narrower way to solve this.
I think that in many instances, what we're going to see in cases right now, we have people who are, because of the 6-3 majority, people who are making pretty adventurous arguments. And the justices, however eager they may be or willing they may be to change the law in a conservative direction, may not always be as willing to go as far as the litigants are asking them to.
Yeah. The court also heard arguments this week in Merrill v. Milligan, the Alabama voting rights case. Here is Justice Samuel Alito suggesting that a community of interest is a proxy for race.
Well, okay, put aside whether or not these are good simulations, but if you have a simulation that takes into account all of the traditional districting factors, but does not take into account race or any proxy for race, such as a community of interest that is defined by race, and you can't get an additional majority-minority district when you do that simulation, what's the consequence?
Liberal justices on the court, including Justice Sonia Sotomayor, pushed back against questions from conservative justices that alluded to their openness to gutting the Voting Rights Act. Here is her pushback to Justice Alito.
Justice Alito gave the game away when he said race neutral means don't look at community of interest because it's a proxy for race. Regrettably, that is what it is. In many situations, that's why Mobile and Baldwin are together.
So, Carolyn, what did you come away from those oral arguments in thinking about what will happen to this Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which allows people to make challenges to districts they say are racially gerrymandered, where that might stand after the court rules?
It was a little hard to predict. It did seem that the court, as similar to what you described in the Clean Water Act case, that the conservative justices were not necessarily interested in going quite as far as the state of Alabama suggested they should go, which would be to even declare Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. But I don't know whether they will be. I think that the chances are that they will say that Alabama's map should be upheld. That's a map that has, out of 7 congressional districts, only 1 majority African-American district in the state that is about 27% African-American. And the clip you played really gets at some of why a narrow reading of Section 2 would be so problematic. The narrow reading of Section 2 that Justice Alito and that the state of Alabama were pushing for, which is a reading of Section 2 that basically pretends that it's not about race. The whole point of the Voting Rights Act is that it's about race, and that it's a way of, the Voting Rights Act is a way of not just ensuring that there aren't facially discriminatory laws, but ensuring that in places where there's racially polarized voting, and Alabama is such a place, that minority voters actually have a meaningful opportunity to participate in the political process, which they don't when they're districted in such a way that they cannot either on their own or in coalition with a few other people win an election.
And Amy, we'll talk a little bit more about this case after our break, but in the minute or so we have left, it seemed like there was an effort to try to take the 14th Amendment and the equal protection prohibition about racial discrimination and use it to reverse, to say, oh, you can't consider race in redistricting at all. Do you think that's something the court might accept?
I'm not sure that they're going to accept it right now. Even Justice Samuel Alito called that argument far-reaching. So that the court, to the extent that you can predict off of oral arguments, seemed inclined to go to the narrower argument, which, as Carolyn said, you know, would still be a real significant hurdle for plaintiffs challenging redistricting plans.
All right, we're going to ask Amy and Carolyn to pause just for a moment. We're discussing the first week of the Supreme Court's new term, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's first oral arguments, and what to expect from this court's conservative supermajority. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. Today, we're talking about the first week of the Supreme Court's new term, what we learn from its first oral arguments, and what cases this court will take up, and what to expect from the newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and from the court's conservative supermajority. With us this hour are Supreme Court reporter Amy Howe and Carolyn Shapiro, founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. So as we mentioned, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson made her debut on the bench this week. Justice Jackson spoke at an event last week following her ceremonial investiture to the court.
I want you to know that I am deeply honored and humbled by the fanfare, and it is no small thing to be so widely encouraged and supported in this way. But I also know that it is not about me. The people who approach, and especially the young people, they are seeing themselves portrayed in me, in my experience, and they are finally believing that anything is possible in this great country.
And Carolyn, you know, we heard Justice Jackson be very active on the bench, that in that Voting Rights Act case, for example, she said more than 2,000 words, which is really unusual for any justice in any case, but it's certainly unusual for a new justice on her first week on the bench. And one thing I thought that was interesting is we talk a lot about originalism and how that usually is something that the conservative members of the court really care about. But Justice Jackson kept going back to the founders in that voting rights case, and she's using a new type of originalism.
That's right. She talked a lot about the framers of the 14th and 15th Amendment. And she said, you know, I think originalism is supposed to be about to the extent it's supposed to be about what it meant at the time, we know that the framers of the 14th and 15th Amendments were very race conscious. They were very interested in trying to figure out how to equalize the experience of the freed African Americans and white Americans. And she had a host of examples to support that position. And it was really striking to hear somebody say that from the bench, just to talk about it in such concrete terms, and to say it with actually almost a tone of confusion in her voice. Like, so why do we think that the 15th Amendment and the Voting Rights Act are supposed to be race neutral? That's never what they were about. I should also add, just in the interest of full disclosure, I should add that I did file a brief in the Voting Rights Act case on behalf of Representative Sewell and some other members of the Congressional Black Caucus, supporting the plaintiffs in the case. And part of the points that we and others made went directly to some of the things that she was talking about, the need to have the fact that the law has helped to create the inequities that lead to the racially polarized voting and the racial housing segregation that we see today.
And Amy, we talked a little bit about this new supermajority, but what have we learned this week about the court's new minority? I've already said that Justice Jackson said more than 2,000 words in the voting rights case. This week, she spoke more words than any other justice. And in second place was Justice Kagan. And I think Sotomayor might have been up there, but there were a few times in that case that she tried to break in, and it took three or four times before she was able to ask her question. What are we learning about these three women who make up the court's minority?
They almost seem to be working together, not necessarily in a planned, strategic kind of way, but in terms of kind of playing off of each other. And Justice Elena Kagan has actually also been very interesting to watch this term, you know, what we've seen of her so far. You know, she had normally not been one to make news outside of the courtroom with her speeches and remarks, but you know, right up until the point that this term started, she was talking to her colleagues in her public remarks, sort of pushing back and saying the court's legitimacy right now is in danger because of the public perception that we are partisan. And on the bench, she seems to have been talking to her colleagues and saying, you know, let's not sugarcoat what I think you're doing here. She was talking about the Alabama voting rights case, which was decided in favor of the challengers by a three-judge court that included two Trump appointees. And she said, look, under our current law, it's a slam dunk. And so sort of trying to make the point, I think, that a ruling for the state would be a change in existing law. And the energy on the court, I think, has really sort of shifted a little bit with the arrival of Justice Jackson. If you had asked me or gone back to look at what I'd said, you know, when Justice Breyer announced his retirement and they nominated Justice Jackson to replace him, I would have said, well, you know, she's bringing a different perspective, you know, as a former public defender, as a Black woman instead of an 83-year-old white man. But, you know, she asks very different kinds of questions than Justice Breyer did. He was known for his sort of long, winding hypotheticals and his focus on the practical. And she's jumping right in with these arguments about originalism.
Yeah. Amy Howe is a Supreme Court reporter for SCOTUS Blog and her own blog, Howe on the Court. Amy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And joining us now from Berkeley, California, is Erwin Chemerinsky. He is Dean of Berkeley Law and author of 14 books, including Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. Erwin, welcome to On Point.
Such a pleasure to talk with you.
And I want to ask you the question that I asked the other guests about this 6-3 majority at the open of this court. What have you learned so far from the arguments that we've heard? And what do you expect of this majority? Do you think there will be the kind of careful line drawing or search for narrower positions? Or do you think there will be more of the kind of cases we saw last term, such as with Dobbs when Roe v. Wade was struck down entirely?
I think this is going to be a term like last term. I think we're going to see this with regard to the affirmative action cases. I think we're going to see it with regard to the voting case that you've been discussing. I think we're going to see it in terms of the ability of people to discriminate against gays and lesbians on account of their religious beliefs or their speech. I think that the six justices in the majority, and especially the five most conservative justices, have a clear agenda, and they're going to push it as far and as fast as they can.
And I want to ask you about the new minority that we've been talking about, the three justices. They were all very active in their questioning this week. What, if anything, do you think they will be able to do to affect these cases? Or is it that their power lies primarily, like this week during oral arguments, trying to expose what they see are the flaws in the arguments that the majority might accept?
When Justice Ginsburg was on the court, along with Justice Breyerson and Kagan, they could occasionally get a majority by attracting one vote. Most frequently, that would have been Chief Justice Roberts. Occasionally, it was Justice Gorsuch. Now, with three liberal justices, they need to get two votes. And they need to get on a court that has five ardent conservatives in Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett, and a strong conservative in John Roberts. It's going to be very difficult in the ideologically defined cases for the three justices who are liberal to do anything but dissent.
And Carolyn, I want to talk a little bit, not just in how the justices decide and rule on cases, but first about the process in, by which they decide whether they even take up a case. And right now we're seeing some issues being taken up by the court that was presented to it in years past, and the court declined to weigh in, but they're weighing in now. Does that have something to do with the current majority and the makeup of the court?
It very well might. Sometimes there are what are called defensive denials, where justices who might want to take a case and would like to see the law move in a particular direction vote not to take a case because they don't think they have the votes to get what they want if the case actually is argued. And so to the extent that cases are coming up that give justices a chance to move the law to the right, I think they have much less reason to worry about that not being successful. And so we're going to see a lot fewer defensive denials. It's consistent with, for example, the court's decision to take the affirmative action cases. The law is pretty clear. It's been clear for a really long time. And what they are being asked to do in those cases is dramatically change the law. They didn't have to take them. The fact that they chose to do that suggests that they are, that the conservative majority is optimistic from their perspective about what they'll be able to accomplish.
And Erwin, might that be a signal of what's to come, even when we look at some of the things that the justices have said in past orders or decisions? For example, Justice Thomas saying in the Dobbs decision that he believes that the court could in the future or should in the future look at some other areas of law that may have been wrongly interpreted in his opinion, just like Roe versus Wade.
I think some of the orders that you referred to do give an indication where the justices are likely to come out. We're going to talk, I'm sure, about a major case later this term about the so-called independent state legislature theory. There was an order, a dissent, where three justices, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, gave us a signal of what they wanted to do. There's major cases now and probably more to come about social media regulation, Section 230. Justice Thomas has given us an indication of where he wants the law to go, and now they have the vehicle to do so. So I think you're right in looking to some of the earlier orders, and I think they tell us at least where the conservative justices want to take the law.
And Erwin, since you mentioned that case, that was one of the cases that the court agreed this week to take up. Tell us about that case and what Section 30 of the CDA does.
Section 230 of the Communication Decency Act says that social media platforms, internet platforms, can't be held liable for that which is placed on them. that as a result, it really means that there's tremendous amounts of speech that can occur on internet and social media because they generally don't have to engage in content moderation. Now, there are some limits. They can't include material that violates federal law or sex trafficking material that violates federal or state law. And the question in these cases, especially in United States versus Gonzalez, is can there be liability for social media companies when terrorist material is placed there? And is there liability with regard to the algorithms that they use in terms of what people receive? Without algorithms, social media platforms like Google or YouTube become unworkable. But how do you hold the social media platforms liable in light of Section 230 or even in light of the First Amendment?
Carolyn, what is your thought about this case and what the implications of it will be once the court begins to wade in to regulating social media in this way?
It's got incredibly broad significance. Keep in mind that this is not the only case that the court could hear that relates to social media liability and regulation. There's a law was passed in Texas that the Supreme Court has actually stayed that would that restrict social media's platform's ability to regulate content at all. Depending on what happens, and whether or not the court decides to give social media companies maintain a significant amount of their immunity from regulation or not, we could see not just increased numbers of lawsuits against social media companies, but also more state laws that attempt to regulate them.
Yes, and we just recently talked about that Texas law on On Point Radio. You can find that show if you go to onpointradio.org. Another thing that happened this week was that President Trump asked the Supreme Court to come in and intervene with respect to a ruling in his ongoing case over documents that were taken to his Mar-a-Lago estate from the White House, some of which were marked as classified. Erwin, was this something surprising to you? And what do you think the court might do?
It wasn't surprising that President Trump decided to ask for Supreme Court review. It's always dangerous to make predictions. Mine is that the Supreme Court will not grant review and will not get involved in this case. I think that the 11th Circuit opinion was so clear that the district court judge, Judge Aileen Cannon, had exceeded her authority. Why she had jurisdiction in this matter at all is questionable. And the grounds that she gave in her opinions are even more dubious. In her second order, which was the one reviewed by the 11th Circuit, she said she had to give great weight to the fact that this was the former president of the United States. That has no relevance under the Fourth Amendment. In her initial order, she said, well, if Donald Trump is indicted, that might be embarrassing. Of course, an indictment is always embarrassing. And I think the 11th Circuit issued a very strongly worded opinion and ruled in favor of the Justice Department. I don't see any reason why the Supreme Court would want to get involved here.
And Carolyn, we're going to talk a little bit more about the so-called shadow docket in the next segment. But when it comes to this case, I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with the former president appealing to the Supreme Court a lot. And we know in the past he has talked about the fact that he has put three justices on the court. How might that impact these repeated appeals to the court that we see the former president making?
Well, I don't think that it's a very good strategic move for him to be reminding everybody that he put three of those justices on the court. It certainly won't. They don't want any people to think that they are voting in his favor if that's how they end up voting because he put them on the court. And in fact, the court hasn't been particularly these personal matters, they haven't been consistently voting in his favor at all. They voted against his efforts to block a grand jury subpoena, against his efforts to block January 6th subpoena. So he's I think way overplaying his hand on that point.
We are discussing the cases the Supreme Court heard this week, the court's plummeting public opinion, and what the justices are saying about their own legitimacy. We'll have more after this break. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This hour, we're diving into what we heard at the Supreme Court oral arguments this week, but we're also talking about larger questions about where the court finished last term and how the court's conservative supermajority may have even a bigger impact on American life with decisions this term. Joining us this hour are Carolyn Shapiro, founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States, and Erwin Chemerinsky, dean of Berkeley Law. And I want to talk to you both about the issue of the court's legitimacy. Justice Elena Kagan has spoken several times in the past few months about public opinion of the court and its legitimacy. She says legitimacy is not about the popularity of the court's opinions. She says it's the job of the court to keep the majority bound to the Constitution, even if it's unpopular. But in a speech at Northwestern University last month, legitimacy is in question when the court appears not to be independent.
When courts become extensions of the political process, when people see them as extensions of the political process, when people see them as trying just to impose personal preferences on a society, irrespective of the law, that's when there's a problem, and that's when there ought to be a problem. So, you know, what makes a court legitimate is that the court is acting like a court, is doing something that's recognizably law-like, and that's when a court will build up some reservoir of public confidence and goodwill.
Chief Justice John Roberts also talked about legitimacy of the court last month at a conference in Colorado Springs on September 9th. He says he doesn't understand the recent questioning of the court.
Lately, the criticism is phrased in terms of, you know, because of these opinions, it calls into question the legitimacy of the court. And I think it's a mistake to view those criticisms in that light. The legitimacy of the court rests on the fact that it satisfies the requirements of the statute and that the Constitution needs, as John Marshall put it, somebody to say what the law is, and that's the role of the Supreme Court. And that role doesn't change simply because people disagree with this opinion or that opinion or disagree with the particular mode of jurisprudence.
So, Carolyn, you've watched this court for a long time. It seems almost as if Roberts is shocked to discover that people are questioning the legitimacy of the court. What's your take about his comments? Do you think he's trying just to say, look, there's really nothing to see here? Or do you think maybe he doesn't really understand it?
Well, I certainly think he's trying to say there's nothing to see here, but I think he's wrong when he says that the reason that the main reason people are questioning the legitimacy of the court is simply that they don't like particular outcomes in particular cases. there's something much more profound happening with this new, very conservative supermajority. They're changing the law in dramatic ways. They are not honoring stare decisis when they don't like what that would lead, the results that that would lead to. And it's also a court that is a minority court in the sense of who is on it. The three justices that President Trump appointed, remember, not only did he not win the popular vote, but those justices were confirmed with the votes of senators who collectively represent millions fewer Americans than the votes of the senators who voted against them. So it is a combination of a strategic hardball played by the Senate in not considering President Obama's nominee, and by the Senate and President Trump in rushing Justice Barrett's nomination through right before the 2020 election, and other factors that created this supermajority that really is not representative of the views of the majority of Americans when it comes to thinking about what the court's role should be, how to interpret the Constitution, et cetera.
And Erwin, I also want your thoughts on the comments of Justices Kagan and Roberts, but also speak to this issue of seeing the justices speaking publicly, sort of seemingly at each other. You know, it's like the speech version of a subtweet, in a way that's we really haven't seen in the past.
The justices in the court have the lowest approval ratings since approval ratings have been measured. The court has the lowest public confidence rating since that's been measured. Or to put this another way, and I agree with what Carolyn said, at a time when our country is more politically polarized than it's been since Reconstruction, what does it mean for the court to have come down so solidly on one side of the divide and so far to the right? In terms of the justices speaking publicly, that's of course changed over the last couple of decades. Justices Scalia and Breyer were among the leaders in that regard. And we came to accept that justices would talk publicly. None of us should be surprised that there's deep tensions among the justices on the court. They, like all of us, care so much about these issues, and they have to deal with them and deal with each other all the time. I think what we've seen is those frustrations come out in the speeches, and I don't think any of us should be surprised by that.
I want to talk, Erwin, for a moment about the shadow docket. We've talked about this topic before on the show. Is that something that you expect to see change? I mean, it seems that once criticism of the shadow docket, and by that we mean cases that the shadow docket is where emergency orders are heard by the court on things that need an immediate ruling. There's no briefing, there's no oral arguments. But increasingly in recent years, rulings on the shadow docket have been made in a way that's essentially on the merits. And Erwin, we know after there was criticism about that, we heard Justices Alito and others push back, but we also saw cases go from the shadow docket to the full merits docket too. So do you think the court is aware of this criticism now and we'll see them handle it a little differently this term?
There's no doubt that they're aware of the criticism, and you're right. We can think of some instances where the court took things from the emergency docket and then briefed in the merits. There was a death penalty case out of Texas where that occurred. There was a voting rights case that was argued this week where that occurred. And yet, I want to talk about the voting rights case that you were discussing earlier and what it shows us about
please.
The shadow docket. This is Merrill versus Milligan, the Alabama congressional districting case. A three-judge federal court found that the district in Alabama violated the Voting Rights Act. Two of the judges on that panel were appointed by President Trump, one by President Clinton. The state of Alabama went to the Supreme Court for emergency relief, and I was stunned that the court, on its shadow docket, 5-4, gave Alabama the relief it wanted. Chief Justice Roberts joined with Brierson and Kagan in dissent. As a result, the discriminatory maps were used for the Alabama primary and for the Alabama election. That was a ruling on the shadow docket. Even though the Supreme Court is hearing the merits of the case, Alabama has won for the 2022 elections. And what was troubling to me is that the usual rules for Supreme Court granting emergency orders weren't followed. In order to have a Supreme Court emergency ruling, it needs to find that there's a substantial likelihood that the party seeking relief will prevail on the merits. There was no such finding in that case.
Mm, that's a good point, and I'm glad you brought that around to the voting rights case that we talked about. Carolyn, something else that was new this week is even though the court has reopened to some extent, there are people in the audience again, the court continued to stream its live audio, its audio of the oral arguments live. Why do you think the court made that decision? Do you think they're concerned about transparency?
Well, I think it's hard to put the toothpaste back in the tube. They started doing this during the pandemic and when there weren't people in the courtroom. And so it didn't seem to have any particularly bad consequences. So I think for them to change that and go back to the way things were, where the audio wasn't released until the end of the week of the argument, really, they would have to come up with some justification, and there just isn't one. I've been an advocate of live streaming the oral arguments for a long time. I think that I can understand, although I don't agree with the arguments against cameras, but I think given that we already have audio and that we have people in the courtroom, there's been no reason not to live stream. So I'm very, very glad that they're continuing to do that.
I want to spend the last few minutes talking about what's ahead for the court. Irwin, you mentioned the 303 Creative case, which is about compelled speech. Tell us a little more about that case.
Lori Smith designs websites in Colorado. She says she wants to design websites for weddings, but doesn't want to do this for same-sex weddings. Colorado has a law, as do many states, that prohibits business establishments from discriminating based on race, sex, religion, sexual orientation. Lori Smith says to require that she, if she's going to design websites, do so for same-sex weddings, violates her freedom of speech and her free exercise of religion. The United States Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit ruled against her. The 10th Circuit said there's a compelling government interest in stopping discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. The Supreme Court granted a review, interestingly, just on the question of whether this violates her free speech. And I think this is different than the Masterpiece Cake Shop from 2018, because designing websites is more clearly speech. On the other hand, the government interest is the same, stopping discrimination. There's always a tension between liberty and equality. Any law that prohibits discrimination limits the freedom to discriminate. For over a half century, the Supreme Court has always said stopping discrimination is more important than protecting a right to discriminate. I think here it's likely the court's going to come down for Lori Smith and open the door to people based on their speech or their religion to violate anti-discrimination laws.
And Caroline, I think that that's interesting that this is a speech case. Justice Alito has made a lot of speeches talking about the issue of religious speech. Do you think that this is a move by the court to sort of move away from this religious expression or religious freedom claim and openly embrace the pushback against some of these civil rights laws on the issue of speech?
Well, I certainly think that's why the court granted just the speech claim and not both the speech and the religion claims. But I don't think that we can read into this a move away from the court's really quite aggressive rewriting of the law regarding religion. They had two very important cases last term where they first told the state of Maine that Maine was going to have to fund religious schools under the circumstances of a particular program that they operate, and they without really fully engaging with the record, they said that a school district had discriminated against this football coach who wanted to pray publicly on the 50-yard line during the game. So I don't see any evidence that their particular grant in 303 Creative means that they're going to pull back on their more expressly religious rulings.
Irwin, this is an unfair question, but can you quickly tell us about the independent state legislature theory case?
Sure. It's Moore versus Harper. In 2019, the Supreme Court said that federal courts can't hear challenges to partisan gerrymandering, but it left open state courts hearing challenges under state constitutions. The North Carolina Supreme Court found that the Republican partisan gerrymandering violated the North Carolina Constitution, even though North Carolina is a purple state, evenly split between Republicans and Democrats. They drew the districts in North Carolina to give Republicans 10 or maybe even 11 seats out of 14. The North Carolina legislature has gone to the Supreme Court and said, under the Constitution, only the legislature gets to decide. There can be no court review. This is based on a provision in Article 1, Section 4 of the Constitution that says state legislatures shall determine the time, place, and manner of elections. If the Supreme Court accepts that theory, then there'll be no place, not federal court, not state court, where partisan gerrymandering can be challenged. And there's another provision of the Constitution in Article 2, Section 1, that says that state legislatures get to decide the allocation of electors from the state in the Electoral College. If the court buys the independent state legislature theory, does that then mean that a state legislature could award the electors however they want, regardless of the popular vote? The consequences of adopting the independent legislature theory would be so enormous for our democracy.
Yeah. And another case that we have is an affirmative action case involving Harvard and the University of North Carolina. Carolyn, the last several times affirmative action came before the court, it survived, but more and more barely each time. Tell us what about this case in our last minute and whether you think the court will rule it out entirely.
Yeah, what the court's being asked to do is to say that any form of race consciousness in admissions is unconstitutional, or in the case of Harvard, violates a federal civil rights law. That would be a dramatic change in the law, because for many years it's been permissible for schools to consider race as part of a more holistic evaluation of the applicants, and in order to have an admitted class that is appropriately diverse for a variety of different reasons. I think it's quite likely that the Supreme Court is going to say that that's not permissible, that any consideration of race is unconstitutional or illegal, and that would have significant repercussions for the way colleges and universities engage in admissions. What's likely to happen is more versions of what we saw in Texas when the Fifth Circuit quite a few years ago said something similar, where Texas implemented what they called the top 10% plan that said that the top 10% of graduating students from public schools could automatically attend the University of Texas, regardless of other qualifications.
Carolyn Shapiro is co-founder and co-director of Chicago Kent's Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Erwin Chemerinsky is Dean of Berkeley Law and the author of 14 books. Erwin, thank you again.
Truly my pleasure.
I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.